Roy with a shot. He scores! Jeff Carter got a piece!
Well, since our last episode, I had some amazing poutine in Montreal that the LA Kings Twitter account made fun of me for. But I also saw a really good movie, Jim. Chinatown.
I
saw it for the first time. It's a great movie.
Very nice. Jack B. Nimble.
Yeah. Great. Great character. So I've seen Pulp Fiction. I've seen Who Framed Roger Rabbit. I've seen Crash. I've seen a whole bunch of LA-centric movies now. Chinatown. What's next on my list?
Hold on. Did you realize that they have just announced a prequel to Chinatown will be filmed?
Really?
Yes. They are uncertain. They assume that Jack Nicholson will not necessarily be involved.
I don't think
he might be able to play his own father.
True. Yeah, there you go. Jack, that'd be interesting.
Jack, you are my father.
No? Chinatown was fun. It was different. It was
pretty intense.
Our producer, Jesse Cohen, is just showing us something. What is he showing?
Great movie.
L.A. Story movie. With Steve Martin.
Ooh. Great movie. Some very, very, very deep topics come up in that movie. Very good.
Okay.
Very well done.
Okay with that.
I like LA Confidential.
Okay, yeah, that was one that I saw. I looked up a list from the LA Times the other day of like 25 LA, the best 25 LA centric movies.
La La Land?
I saw La La Land, yeah. That was good.
You mentioned that or
it's good. Mention that. I saw that when it came out. Every time I drive on that ramp on the 105 freeway, I think, oh, that's where they filmed that. That's kind of neat.
I got out of my car and actually started dancing and stuff.
Really?
Yes.
That's why your toe's broken.
Yes, it is. Along with the closet door in Glendale, Arizona. Yesterday, game day. Broken toe on a game day, but I still went.
Hey, you know what? Played. You're a hockey player.
I was there.
You hockey players, you're tough. I also gave you, before we officially get underway, I gave you one great stat on the plane. And I surprised you with a stat. I was so proud of this. Leon Draisaitl leads the NHL in goals since January 1st. Jesse's right next to me. I'll surprise him. Who do you think is number two?
Oh, I know who it is.
Say the stat again.
Leon Draisaitl leads the NHL in goals since January 1st. Who's second? Come on, Jesse. No. It's a good guess.
Yeah.
It's not Alex Ovechkin. It's Brad Marchand. But as we were talking, a little bit surprised to see his name up there.
Outward opinions based on someone's personality affect the way you analyze and evaluate them as an effective player.
I was about to say something disparaging towards you, but now you're not even top 10 in scoring in LA Kings history, so I can't really. That's adding insult to injury there.
That is. Man, that hurts.
And with that, let's get the podcast underway. Episode number 4.
I had a comeback, but
it's fine.
I won't.
Fox
I won't
and Faust
lower myself
podcast. All right. From the Steve Duchesne podcast studio, next to the employee break room at the LA Kings office in El Segundo, California, welcome to Fox and Faust, the podcast, episode number 4. This week, the curious case of the underdog.
What?
A sea change on Saturday night.
What?
A brief look at the Hall of Fame weekend. And what happens when you put 31 general managers in the same room at the same time? A lot of egos in that room. Bit your tongue on that one, huh? No? Not by
swearing.
Biting? Yeah.
Lots of swearing.
A little bit. But we begin with Ilya Kovalchuk.
Kobe.
Before we dig in, I want to give a little bit of background on the story from our perspective, just to show how out of the loop we are on this sort of stuff. So driving into Staples Center, November 12th, phone is blowing up. All these people are texting, what? Have you seen this thing on Kovalchuk? You seen this thing on Kovalchuk? I'm like, what? What's going on with him? And then I see Elliot Friedman's report. At the same time that this thing comes out, we're discussing how we're going to approach this on our show, because this is the lead story, right? This is one of the star players that the Kings have signed, $6+ million, and now he's out of the lineup. the Kings are not going to put out a news report confirming or denying a news story. So instead, there's a media availability with Rob Blake in Staples Center press box. And we talk to Blakey all the time, Jim. He's very even-keeled, very matter-of-fact, doesn't really let on too much. But this time he was clearly upset that there was a story being talked about and stated emphatically that Kovalchuk is a healthy scratch, nothing more.
Well, he's a healthy scratch.
Same as, I don't want to give away. Same as Adrian Kempe. The reason we didn't say anything today is because we've got a game to play, but he's a healthy scratch.
Since then, four games, four times out of the lineup. I'll end there and ask you, Jim, what's your take on this whole situation with Ilya Kovalchuk being out of the lineup for the LA Kings?
First of all, I'll touch on what I believe, just only my opinion, and Rob Blake's reaction is this. If the source was internal, he would be irate and should be irate. If the source is external, he can be unhappy with it and express his displeasure. Bottom line, like he mentioned, healthy scratch. So I think that most general managers like to be in control of the information that leaves their office. I don't think that's a surprise to anyone. But sometimes you're not always in control of that. Once again, if it would be an internal leak, I'm sure Rob is trying to find that out, find out exactly what happened. I don't think, knowing Elliot, in my personal experience, I don't have any reason not to believe him. I think he is very credible. So then again, I think Rob is turning his attention to how the information was released to Elliot.
And the matter of Kovalchuk being out of the lineup, because it's now 4-for-4, right? And something's afoot, because you don't usually have a player who is a big part of your strategy about a year and a half ago all of a sudden disappear from the lineup for no reason.
Well, there is a reason, and I believe the reason is this. I believe that the style of the National Hockey League makes it more difficult for Ilya Kovalchuk's style to be effective. I think in the past, obviously, he was effective. He has borderline Hall of Fame numbers. So as a scorer, I don't think there is any doubt what happened then. I think you have to go back to the signing. At the time of the signing, the Kings felt that they were still there as a contender. Four straight to Vegas, but four close games, and the games not won because the Kings could not produce enough offense. The defense was not the issue. So they went for a sniper. Max Pacioretty was the guy on the list. Well, they felt his numbers. He was unrestricted free agent. He's asking too much. Max decided not to accept the Kings' offer, ended up going to Vegas, somewhere else. There was trades involved and those types of things. But I'm sure a contract situation was agreed upon previous to that. This is my take on Ilya. I watch him every day in practice. For those who feel he has slowed down, I disagree. I watch him executing the same plays at top speed that I've seen him in the past. That's practice. Can you do it in the game? I don't think that's the case. As I've used the art analogy before, and this is the way I feel. I feel that Ilya Kovalchuk can still paint, but the canvas has changed. I believe Ilya is still trying to paint Picasso, and the Kings want paint by the numbers. They want more structure. So for that reason, I believe the game as a whole around him, the league has changed. And what they're looking for from Ilya is to make adjustments to the way he approaches the game. And will those adjustments affect his bottom line numbers? Probably. But they would be hoping that the adjustments would make him a less risky player when he has the puck. When he doesn't have the puck, I don't think anyone expected a Selke Trophy winner. We knew that. But I think that the gamble, or whatever you want to call it, the decision that the Kings made no longer applies. Times have changed. The Kings have changed directions, and the league has. And unfortunately, at this point, Ilya has not found a way to earn his way into the lineup.
I think the Kings made their direction clear last year when they traded Jake Muzzin, that other than a handful of players, there are no sacred cows anymore. There's nobody that is untouchable, right? From trade, from being held out of the lineup. I think that's been clear this year even. Prior to being taken out of the lineup, Kovalchuk had one goal, 3 points in the 13 games prior. -8, 10 penalty minutes. Tom McLellan was saying earlier this year, you pay him that much money to fill up the net. And it just wasn't happening. He had been demoted to effectively the fourth line. So this was not something overnight that happened of, oh, he's out of the lineup. Poof. Strategy changes. This had been a process that had gone on through the first dozen games or so this season. Much as you said, the whole first 20 games is an evaluation. And it seems in that evaluation that Kovalchuk doesn't fit right now.
If he's not scoring on the power play, then he's not going to be a big part of the group. And whether they were not using him correctly, you can make that argument. I've seen him give up shots or not take shots. I heard a story, actually didn't see it at the time, but then followed up on replay where, again, Alexander Ovechkin on a power play, one shot blocked, three shots in a row blocked, next shot in. Keep shooting. Unfortunately, have not seen that. So that's where I don't look at the plus minus. I don't look at those types of things. I look at on the power play. Has he been used effectively or has he been able to be effective? We have not seen that. And all of a sudden, if that goes away, I think your ice time goes away. Can he come back? Yes. If he had 5 goals and 1 assist at this point, and 4 of those goals were on the power play, I think he'd still be in the lineup.
Yeah. We could also go down this road and say maybe the signing didn't work. A year plus in, we could just say it didn't work. Think about this. To sign Ilya Kovalchuk, Kings didn't have to give up anything. Mm-hmm. All they had to do was give up cash. And we know that this is a deep-pocketed team with an owner that's willing to spend. And yes, it's a business, so $6 million is nothing to sneeze at per year. But they didn't have to give up draft picks, didn't have to give up prospects, didn't have to give up rostered players. 81 games, 19 goals, that's about 5 or 6 shy of maybe where you'd project them over a full season. Possession numbers aren't awful, and as you said, you're not going to look at plus minus for a guy like this, but...
You make decisions based on what's going on at the time.
Yeah.
And at the time, they made that decision. I think you just mentioned, Alex, we could go back and go through that and say it's the wrong decision, all those types of things. A very smart man once told me, and I was just happening to walk through the Great Western Forum one day, and I think he's been successful at what he has done, but he told me, as a manager, if you make a mistake, but you believe in what you were trying to do, keep doing it. Do it again. Keep going after it. If you you're the manager. They have paid you to set the direction of the team. And you decided to go for an offensive player because you felt an offensive player was needed. Don't change that in the future. Keep going. Now, again, things have changed around the Kings. The roster and the decision they're making on have changed in that 1 year. But that gentleman told me it's very important to stick to your guns. That's the reason you were hired. His name was Jerry West. So he's done a pretty good job. Now, again, if Rob makes another decision going after an offensive player and it doesn't work, well, he's analyzing what he feels the team needs. And, of course, at this point, I think the analyzing is not the same as it was back then. Do people disagree with the decision at the time? Yes, a lot of people did. I was not one of those people. In all honesty, I put my cards on the table. I thought, okay, the Kings couldn't score. They needed to score. And I don't think his skills have diminished. I really don't. I just think the game has changed around him. And if that's something the Kings could have seen, could have predicted, perhaps they might have made a different decision. But at the time, man, I wish all the decisions I made in my life could be based on.
I'd like to have a year of hindsight to make certain decisions.
And there's a lot of reasons to critique or criticize a general manager like a Rob Blake. There's a lot. I think right now people have to be a little bit wary. What I'd like them to do is to consider the situation Rob was placed in, the contracts that were signed. He has to deal with. I don't know if I've mentioned it on the cast before, but I believe if you go up to 30 of the 31 general managers, all the ones that didn't win last year, and you gave them the option to take the rules in an expansion draft like Vegas had, I believe 25 of the 30 would say, yes, I'll take that right now. You know why? Because you are not burdened with contracts you do not want. And you can start all over. Now, again, this would have to happen one at a time. It's not like they could all happen all of a sudden, because then your player pool is not going to be as strong. But so, and you know what? Rob is in a position where he will be criticized. He's a general manager. He's making decisions that affect the direction of an organization. But some of them, I think, and you know what? You probably put the Kovalchuk one in that area of, okay, Rob, your decision, your foresight just doesn't fit where. But now they've decided, and I think, I don't know if it applies. It might be apples and oranges, but the Jerry West thing is, don't. Rob is Rob. He's the Kings general manager. Stick with it.
He has an idea, and clearly they have a plan. Now, I would even go so far as to ask fans, is Ilya Kovalchuk the reason why the Kings are in last place in the division? Ask yourself that. No way. No way.
Most people feel the Kings are where they were predicted to be.
Yeah. And
that's not good. It's not easy. It's not fun. It's frustrating. But it's also a process. A very easy argument can be made that the best way to be good is to be real bad. Drew Doughty, number two overall.
He came out of after some really bad teams.
Now, you don't want to plan that, but, and again, maybe Edmonton, who are coming around, though, but did they have three first overalls in a row?
They whiffed on a couple.
So they should be. Well,
they're in first place, Jim, at the moment.
They have some exciting players.
Yes, I've heard of a couple of them.
By the way, you know what?
Yeah.
I don't think Zach Cassian gets enough credit for what he does. I think he is a big body who is quick enough to get around the ice and be a complementary player with two superstars. That's difficult to do. I don't think, earlier, maybe dumb penalties, maybe over aggressive. That's an aside. How is that?
That's a good aside. I want to see how long can the Draisaitl McDavid 28 minutes a night experiment go? Because at some point they've got to hit a wall, you'd think.
I would just make this assumption that in a playoff series, when you can focus on the other team's best players and try to take them away, if you can even begin to diminish the effectiveness and production of those two players, you're going to win the series against Edmonton.
Yeah, that's why James Neal is there, and James Neal has 12 goals when he had 7 all of last year, so. You never know. James is a pretty good playoff player. By the way, Ilya Kovalchuk, Hall of Fame?
I do side with people who say, if you have to think about it, then no. So you heard my hesitation. Mm-hmm. I would have to research his international success, because I think that's one thing we overlook here in North America. My first prerequisite for Hall of Fame is this. You have to be in the top five of your position for at least 5 years in a row. He might fit that. Again, I would have, the reason for my hesitation is I don't have the numbers in front of me.
I'll give you a few to chew on. So, led the league in goals in 04. Third in the league in goals in 06, lockout in between. Second in the league in goals in 08, so it's not 5 years in a row there. Top five in 09. Yeah. Like he's up there, top six in goals.
No, then he has passed the test for my first prerequisite.
There you go. One time, the 2004 season, won the Richard Trophy.
It's the best.
And you know what? Add in his time in the KHL, would have played 1,000 games if he'd stayed in North America. Olympic gold medalist.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a pretty good case,
good
I think.
Good resume.
Yeah. Pretty good case, I think. Speaking of Hall of Fame, Hall of Fame weekend in Toronto. You had a great story on TV. I don't know if folks caught it during the intermission on Monday. I don't know if you want to retell the story now that we have a little bit more time to do it, but your experience with one of the Hall of Famers.
Very interesting because I would say a lot of my friends that I've met here in Los Angeles, for whatever reason, I know the reason, a gentleman who's passed away a while ago, Mike Bielik, who was from the Czechoslovakia at the time.
Yes, yeah.
He was a big sports fan, big hockey fan, and actually when a lot of athletes from former Czechoslovakia or Czech Republic or Slovakia would come to L.A. to play, Martina Navratilova, those, they would stay at his house. He would make sure everything was taken care of for them. Because of hockey, he helped the Kings hockey players that came from Czech Republic or Czechoslovakia. And so I had a chance to meet him. And I just met more and more people from that area of the world. And another good friend who I mentioned on the air has been dealing with some very serious health issues of late, Peter Schultz, and on his way to recovery, he told me a story about what happened in the 1969 World Championships. It was when Václav Nedimanský was representing Czechoslovakia. That was 1 year after the Russians had taken over Czechoslovakia. The reason Jager Way 68, 1968. So the next World Championships that took place, obviously the animosity between the players from Czechoslovakia and Russia was beyond sport, right? It was beyond sports. Ned was a superstar over there. I mean, he was dominant, big, strong, offensive. Well, in the game they played Russia early in the... I've seen tapes of this because Peter has them, and they're old, black and white, and you can hardly see it because I think it's only like one camera coverage. You know, you don't have a whole bunch of angles to go back and replays, but early in the game, maybe his first shift, if I'm not mistaken, Ned picks up a puck and he's going blue line to blue line. He's in the neutral zone. He's at full speed. He's going to attack the offensive blue line. He stops on a dime. Turns and faces the Russian bench and slap shots the puck right into the bench. His way of protesting what had happened to his country. Sometimes how politics crosses into the sports arena. So got to know Ned quite a bit because he was a scout here with the Kings. Still scouting, or he has scouted in the National Hockey League for the last little while. I think it's great that the Hall of Fame committee is going outside of North America. And back to the Kovalchuk thing, that's why I'd have to see his actual numbers to see where, you know, because those should be taken into consideration.
It is the Hockey Hall of Fame, not just the NHL Hall of Fame. And I know you're a big fan, and you've probably heard this before, Bobby Orr. And you're from Ontario. So naturally you would, in theory, at least this is outside looking in, gravitate towards the Leafs, right? But Bobby Orr was your favorite player growing up. And you got to see him a whole bunch on Hockey Night in Canada, obviously. But I've always been a little bit intrigued of why you picked Bobby Orr as your favorite player.
I just think it was what he did to change the game. It was over and above an allegiance to the team that's closer to me. He grew up a two-hour drive from where I grew up,
okay.
Parry Sound, Ontario. I'm from just outside of Sudbury, Ontario, small town Coniston. So that probably, there's probably more news about him, right? When you drove by Parry Sound, big sign, the home of Bobby Orr. But, you know, Boston was winning championships. You know, I was 8, 9, 10, 11 years old. So that's why I choose him. Overall, I had another athlete that I looked up to, which, you know, I've come to learn is very controversial. Didn't realize it at the time. Didn't know the landscape of what was going on. I was old enough to know what Vietnam was, but not old enough to really understand. Muhammad Ali was my hero. Like, he, even above, you know, hockey players, just happened to see clips of him and the way he carried himself and the boasting, and it just drew my attention. And then my dad would always tell me, if you can back it up in the ring, you can say whatever you want. And he backed it up in the ring. And I know I've tweeted that out before, and I've had some responses back from people who are Vietnam veterans and not happy with his stance, and I completely understand that. I would ask them to understand that I was a, you know, 8, 9, 10-year-old kid at home in Canada, really not figuring out what's going on there. But I cried when I listened to the radio broadcast when he lost the first fight to Joe Frazier. I cried. I was just devastated that Muhammad Ali actually lost. But, you know, he came back and had, you know, but just... So it's interesting who you pick and choose, right? It's just right. Very, very interesting.
But your sporting heroes were the preeminent, and that's natural, right? To pick guys who are at the height of their respective sports. I think a lot of, you know, regardless of whether we have a rooting interest in sports, we gravitate to superstars, right? But reflexively, it's kind of interesting on a team basis. We tend to cheer for the underdog if we don't have any sort of rooting interest. I know in March Madness, when you fill out a bracket, right, you're thinking, all right, is there going to be upsets? That's all anyone cares about in March Madness. Who's going to get upset in the first round? And that's the joy of watching, is the chaos, right? That's why they call it madness. But you go the opposite way, almost to making a caricature of when we're looking at the scores from around the league. Or from college football, my Alabama Crimson Tide, my LSU Tigers, and it's always the team that's winning. But there's a bit behind that, right?
There's a deep story. There's a story where I have actually sought out professional help for. Because when I was growing up, guess who I was?
The guy.
I was the top guy. When I was 8 years old, when I was 10 years old, when I was 12 years old. When I was 12 years old, a little kid came up to me and asked me for my autograph because wow. They saw me play hockey. So I was always, and then hockey, track and field, soccer, baseball, whatever.
Not basketball?
Basketball, yeah. Everything, you know, I was the best athlete in my little area. And then as I grew up and when I was continued to be at the top. So guess what happened? People were always shooting me down. Always shooting me down. When I was 12 years old, our little team in Coniston played all the way through till they got to the final series that they would ever play that year. And all year long, my dad, who was the coach, heard from parents, Jim Fox is playing too much. He's playing too much. He's playing too much. He can't play. He's playing too much. My kid needs to play more. Jim Fox is playing too much. We never lost a game.
This is before the helicopter parents of 2010s. Yep.
never lost a game. Well, in the first game of a two-game series against this one team, my dad decided not to play me. So I get to the game, didn't know anything about it. He just told me before the game, Jim, you're not going to play today. I said, Dad, no problem. I dressed up, was on the bench. When there was a delayed penalty against the other team, I would jump on for the goaltender, but other than that, I was never put on the ice. We were losing. What did the parents scream? We want Jim. We want Jim. We want Jim. Maybe a difficult thing for a kid to go through, learning lessons, but you know, I think a lot of people in, you know, Little League or, you know, soccer, when you're growing up, my dad just was fed up. He was fed up with all these, hearing these complaints. So 5 minutes left in the game, he puts me on, we win. So I had to go through those things. And I know I am unusual compared to most. That was just my upbringing. So when I watch a game now, I want to see the favorite win. I want to see them win because I know what it's like to be chopped down when you're the favorite. And that unique to me. Do I feel good when an underdog wins? Yeah. I mean, I can feel the
miracle in Manchester.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, that was, I have both citizenships, right?
Mm-hmm.
When Canada loses in hockey, I'm devastated. Because you know why? Because they're the favorite. And to go back to their country, they're just picked apart. If it's basketball, I want to see the U.S. win. Because the same thing, and that's, again, it's only my perspective, but it certainly affected me, and it affected me for my whole life. Where just, you know, being the top dog is nice, it's great, but you also see at some point, at sometimes, you see how ugly it can get.
There's a lot of pressure involved when you have a target on your back, right? That's part of it too.
For no reason other than just excelling at a sport.
Yeah. I'm going to give you a rebuttal though, and I hope
rebut
maybe to change your thinking just a little bit. Why do we watch sports?
To see who wins or loses.
Exactly. Do you watch sports more when the outcome is in doubt or when the outcome is in hand?
When the outcome is in hand.
Really? You would rather watch a 35-0 blowout in college football?
As long as the team that's supposed to win is winning 35-0.
Really?
Yes.
So you wouldn't want to see a team like Alabama like squeak out a 35-33 win to remain unbeaten?
I don't have fun. I'm anxious.
That's why we watch.
I don't have fun.
We're anxious. We're on the edge of our seats.
When Jeff Carter scored 4-0 goal, that's when I relaxed.
Ah, yes.
That's when I relaxed.
2012 Stanley Cup final.
Until that moment, I was, and that's watching. Playing's a whole different thing. You can get through you can play through it because your nerves are, your nervous energy is taken up by, you got to do, you got to execute, you got to go out there. Watching is, I find it very difficult. To the point where, man, recent series Anaheim was playing. Chicago. Game 7 in Anaheim 3 or 4 years ago. I go into my room. My wife's out watching the game. I go into my room and I watch 3 episodes of NCIS.
What?
You know why? Because I know at the end of 3 episodes, the game's going to just about be over. 3 hours. You know, it's just about, well, Chicago beats Anaheim. They had a 4-0 lead. I'm mad at my wife. Why didn't you come and tell me they're up 4-0? You know, I mean.
Wow.
Now I know why she didn't, because if she would, I would have been madder.
So you're one of those people that can't look. You're one of those in the stands, like I've seen like spouses and children who literally cover their eyes because they can't look. It's too tense.
I wish I could. My dad was like that. He couldn't watch. He'd have to walk around the arena. Jerry West, right? He has to walk. Just a different makeup. That's all. The two favorite moments in my hockey thing were not the games that won the Stanley Cup. Were the parades, because I didn't have to worry about the outcome anymore. That was that's
embrace the stress.
I know.
Embrace.
Never. I don't think I've done a good job of that.
Drama. No. That's why we watch sports. That's why we watch. And there's a great, there's a theory out there that with regard to ticket sales and with regard to TV ratings, that, you know, when TV networks program these things, they want to put games on where the outcome is in doubt, not just the number one team is involved. Sometimes that's the case because that's all you have. But that the outcome is in doubt and more people might watch. Oh, we might get an upset here today. Again, going back to the whole idea of March Madness, sometimes the only moments you remember are UMBC over Virginia or Butler making it to the Frozen Four, or the Final Four, I should say. Frozen Four, but plenty of upsets too. Holy Cross over Minnesota, 2006 NCAA Ice Hockey Tournament. They're playing it in Grand Forks at North Dakota.
And I feel for Minnesota.
Oh, Holy Cross with North Dakota fans all around the rink cheering on Holy Cross just because they're Holy Cross and just because we can knock the Gophers out, right?
Great moment.
Yeah, great moment. But great and I can understand feeling for those kids who had all the pressure on their shoulders and couldn't get it done.
I turned on the TV last year when we got, when there was 9 seconds on the clock when the Toronto Raptors won. And that was too early.
That was a tense series.
Then I found out that there was a foul or something going on, and they actually had the ball, and they had the lead. So I said, okay. But if they didn't have the ball, well, they were my Raptors.
They were.
Did they win?
Yes, they're
my Raptors then.
We shall see if it's your Lakers or your Clippers this year that, that wound up being. One more before we kind of get on. Lakers?
Yep.
Ooh. Well, yeah, that's true. We got the... We got a little connection here.
Dr. Bus.
Yeah.
Yep.
AG's still part owner, too, of the team. So we're a little bit closer to them. I wanted to ask you one more thing about the week that was. Don Cherry on Saturday night, Hockey Night in Canada. I mean, this was the story across the entire nation for a week for a guy that appears on television 6 minutes per week. And had been, granted, had been doing so for 40 years, but the number one story. This was earth-shattering for the hockey world, in Canada at least.
Unfortunate, but not unexpected. I think I've said many times before that I felt just because of the makeup, he was an icon. He is an icon.
Still.
And for many, many times for the right reasons, many times for the wrong reasons. But I felt that if he were working in the United States, I believe he would have been let go from his duties many years ago, just because of the scrutiny we put on certain areas of our society compared to Canada. And keep in mind, again, in Canada, he is the top. He's right there. Who is more popular than him? Who is more unpopular than him? So there you have it. You have both. So this is not the place to get into what he said and why they let him go. But like I say, unfortunate, but not unexpected.
I'll be fascinated to see... how they evolve that segment, because at the end of the day, the medium of television in general needs to get younger. In an age where you have streaming options, where you have Netflix, where you have TikTok, a new social media platform, which is capturing what Gen Z now, you need to get younger on television. And you had an 85-year-old guy.
I think you need to get older.
Really?
Yes.
Why?
Because I'm older than you.
So? I'm not about to go start saying okay boomer to you, because that would be rude.
What you need to do is make your network successful.
Yeah. Sponsors are paying money.
If that means going to a different demographic as far as age, then you go that way.
Fascinating to see what they do next.
We have the opportunity, we being the older people, have the opportunity to adapt and change,
mm-hmm.
where the young people never have our experience.
It's very true. It's very true. I would venture to say...
I learned something from you every game. I've told you that.
Uh-huh.
From a broadcasting standpoint, because I wasn't schooled in broadcasting. I wasn't, you know, so I know what people say, you know, from the technical aspect or hockey or tactics, hopefully I can help people see, but... And a lot of that is because of I think your age, your energy, the information you collected in that area, and that has helps. It helps me a lot, because there's a lot of technical things that I never ever dealt with before, and perhaps hopefully I can learn to deal with them.
Jim, you have forgotten more about hockey than I'll ever know in my life, so we'll just leave it at that. This week in Toronto, the other thing that I wanted to get to here, GM meetings are taking place. A couple of things that came up recently probably top of mind for everybody in hockey right now. Everybody's talking about the Matt Calvert incident in Colorado, uh-huh. And how officials are going to handle this going forward. If you're not familiar with it, Matt Calvert, defensive player for the Colorado Avalanche against the Vancouver Canucks, gets struck with a puck, side of the head. The rule book is very clear in that until the defensive team, or unless there's a change in possession of the team that the injured player is being affected, until they touch the puck, play continues. Matt Calvert, behind the play, tries to get up, fails multiple times. But what was interesting here is Vancouver then scores. Play continues, mm-hmm. and they score a goal on yep. this. Is there a rule change needed here?
I would suggest one, and I'll get to that. First of all, I'd like to deal with the reaction of the Colorado players.
I mean, that rule is pretty crazy. A guy laying there bleeding out to the side of his head. I can only imagine if that was LeBron James and his head was bleeding and they let their team either take a 3-point to tie up the game. I know it's not the ref's fault. It's the league rule. I think you got to look and see who's laying on the ice. It's Matt Calvert, one of the toughest guys I've ever played with, and I don't think he's faking it. Try to get a whistle.
Completely understandable to me. But when I watched it for the first time, I did not see where he was struck with a puck. I believe the officials, no one saw that he was hit in the head. The way he went to block the shot and then actually spun his body around. So that was a little bit unusual. So when it's unusual, many times it takes a longer time to process what you just saw. The referees can blow it down if they feel it's a head injury or something very dangerous to your well-being. Some of the comments, I understand the comments, but if the officials did see that, they would have blown it down. What you were talking about, Calvert trying to get up a couple times. When I watched that, to me, I didn't know he was as injured as he was, or where he was injured is probably the best way to be concerned, or the area where we should be concerned, because it ended up being a puck in the head. As far as I'm aware, again, there was no visible dripping of blood because it was underneath his helmet. Now, that all of these things are not an excuse. It happened so quick. The reason the rule is there is, you know why? Because players would fake it. They get hit, they go down, they fake it, whistle, bump, pressure's off. So you've got to have something going on. Very unusual the way it did happen. I'm going outside the box here. I'm going to soccer. Pedersen took the shot, correct? Pedersen.
Yep, I believe so.
He saw the contact, at least it looked like he saw the contact. Because he kind of put his hands up, or at least what I would call for is this. Player who has on the team that's in possession of the puck that assumes there's a serious injury to a player on the ice. He raises his hand in a fist like the trainers do to signal everyone there's an injury. Whistle is blown immediately. You attend to the player. You do not restart action with a face-off. You restart action with giving the team that had possession of the puck at the blue line in the offensive zone with the other players inside the tops of the circles. So you have time to restart the play. It's much like in soccer. If they feel someone's hurt, really hurt, they kick the ball out of bounds. You restart. The team that gets it, they give it right back to the same team. Yeah. Now, this one happens in the offensive zone, so you have a good chance of scoring. In soccer, it could happen in the defensive zone and there's really no chance.
Right.
It's kind of a sportsmanship thing. I'm just throwing it out there because Pettersson knew that there was a potential injury. I can understand why the officials didn't pick it up because of how disguised the point of contact was, and also because of Calvert's, unfortunately, by trying to get up a couple times, it appeared like he was in total control of his senses, and we did know. Now, when he gets attended to, he takes his helmet off, and all of a sudden we see it's right in the temple, basically, or on that side of the head, and there's blood, and it could have been a pretty serious thing.
In hindsight, it looks a lot worse than when, as you're saying, when live action is taking place. The other weird thing about this that's different is, as a defensive player, more often than not, you're facing the shooter, You see the puck coming. You're able to turn. You're able, and these guys have such good reaction time. They're able to get out of the way for the most part. Very rarely do we see a defensive player hurt. A lot of times it's an offensive player because they've got other things. They're trying to get to the right position, and they'll get struck, and they just never see the puck coming. So it's blown dead. We never really think about it in that regard. But because it was a defensive player here, it was just a little bit different in that. I don't think there's a rule change necessary. I think it's just officials should be wary of injuries and if something looks serious. Because, to your point, you don't want players faking it.
To me, it didn't look serious. And to me, the officials felt it didn't look serious. Serious, let's put that in context. Coley Campbell's son there in Boston a couple years ago was hit with a slap shot on the ice. Penalty kill. Broke his leg. Stayed on the ice. They didn't blow the whistle. That's serious. It's a broken leg, but it's not life-threatening.
Right, right.
Head injury, life-threatening, or certainly more serious. So you've got to figure that all out. I know my suggestion is a little bit outside the box, but I'm just trying to... I think we're in that age now where players, as a group, are taking care of each other's health, more so than we've ever done before.
Especially with the focus on issues related to concussions and head injuries specifically in the game. The players used to police it, we've talked about it before, by way of having an enforcer. Now they're policing it by way of they just don't do it anymore. Mm-hmm. And if there is somebody who does it, they raise it to the union or they'll raise it to the league directly. That's a different world.
I'm going to jump to a new thing.
Yeah.
Player safety. It involves the spitting incident.
Oh, yeah. This was a new one.
So what is the proper supplemental discipline for that action?
This was in Washington, D.C. on Monday night. Capitals Ducks. And I believe it was Chandler Stephenson, right?
I don't have the information in front of me. So I don't have the names. But... I think Branson was the defenseman for Anaheim. If it does go to a supplemental discipline, is it player safety here?
It's Garnet Hathaway. Okay. That was the player involved.
Does it fit into the realm of player safety? Some people would say yes, because you're exchanging a body fluid, and that has a potential infection issue.
Brad Marchand licking? Going back to that.
Place it into the context of what are the chances are, the percentages of a serious injury developing. So do you place this in the same thing as running someone from behind, squarely in the back, into the boards with a potential of a head or neck injury?
Is there a false equivalency when we do that, though? Like, we want decorum and we want sportsmanship in our game, and even though it might have the same number of games for a suspension as a illegal check to the head, I don't see a fault. I don't see an equivalency there.
I see a big difference in player safety. I don't think it endangered Gudbranson as much as the other acts we see punished with supplemental discipline. Is there a human? That's why I don't even know if this goes to player safety. It still might be dealt with, say, 5 games, which is a very serious hit. If you have a hit from behind, if you're a first-time offender, you know that would be a very serious thing to get 5. But maybe it goes to another committee, so to speak, where they would deal with it. Or maybe it starts in player safety and say, this just doesn't really fall in our category. Maybe we have to go to someone else. Then as a whole... It's just interesting to me how it's going to be dealt with. I don't know how
there
it is.
There is a rule in the rule book about
it. Yes, you can.
Yeah, you can't spit on an opponent. It's rule 23.8. Mm-hmm. It's a game misconduct penalty.
Right.
Which you're out for the rest of the game. And if you rack up enough of those over the course of a season, it's an automatic suspension anyway.
But I've heard, you know, people talking about the factor of suspending him, I'm not ruling that out either. That sounds like a remedy that I could live with. I'm just wondering, player safety really wasn't a factor here. Not a high percentage chance that he was going to be injured on the play. Is there a human nature thing here not to do it? Yeah. And maybe, examples. They're professional athletes. They're an example. Maybe that has to be, hey, you can't do this, kids. Maybe that's where you go. Maybe that decorum aspect as opposed to player safety.
Yeah, this is an interesting. This goes. I immediately think of Marshawn when I'm seeing this incident, but I'll be fascinated to see how, because I don't recall him being suspended by that. It was just, don't do it again.
Right.
And you can very fine. Stern, don't do it again.
You can fine, but that, yeah. You know, you don't lose any, miss any time.
All right, let's get to some questions before we wrap up here from our very loyal listeners. Yes, number one, from Clement. Or Clement, I don't know. How do you decide your wardrobe for each game? Does it change depending on the opponent or even the occasion the game is played on?
Ask Susie.
My wife tends to have say over what I wear each game too. I will say we did get our Hockey Fights cancer ties today, yes. So we'll be wearing those on Saturday. I go back. I don't like wearing any colors resembling the opponent. If the opponent is blue, there are a lot of blue teams. Okay, I'll wear a blue suit or something, but I don't want to be all blue if we're playing a blue opponent. If we're playing the Blackhawks, I'll avoid a red tie. If we're playing the Wild, I'll avoid anything green. So that's the only thing I try not to do because I don't like the appearance of I'm wearing the color. Because we, for our Kings thing, we wear black and white to events. So I don't want to even have the appearance of wearing the other team's colors, even though it doesn't matter in the end.
Yeah, I don't worry about it that much. I worry about how many games are on a road trip and how many things will go together at the same time with establishing the minimum amount of suits I have to bring.
What's the minimum?
Two suits for a five-game trip. Anything over five, got to go more.
Well, I do three for five only because I feel like I don't want to wear something three times in a... So once I go to six or more, yeah, or five or more, I'll do three suits.
One shirt for every game. Never wear the same shirt twice. And one tie for every game. Never wear this same tie twice on a road trip.
Fair. Can't do the same outfit in general. Let's see. SoCal Crosscheck asks, are there any steps you'd like to see the Kings take to speed up the rebuilding process?
My immediate reaction is, if it could be sped up, it wouldn't be a retool rebuild. That's just, I understand. Speeding up, I think you need to keep a certain amount of veterans around to supply the mentorship that is needed to move forward. There is a difference. What Dean Lombardi did is different than what, first have to say is this. No salary cap back then, salary cap now. Huge difference. But what Dean did was he tore down before he rebuilt. Easier to tear down when you're in a bigger control of contracts than it is when you're not a big control of contracts. So I don't know if there is a way to speed it up.
If they were looking to speed it up, they'd be doing it. I think it's very clear that they've got a plan in mind, which is different than the plan that they had when they went with Ilya Kovalchuk last season. They've clearly pivoted to say, you know what? Draft picks and college free agents are going to be the way that they start this thing. Over the long haul, we'll see. Yeah.
Speed it up. I mean, you're going to have unrestricted free agents. You make the assumption that those are the players that will be leaving.
Going through, there are a lot of similar questions on Kovalchuk here that I think we've touched on. Seeing if there's anything else here. Poutine, yes or no?
Don't know if I've ever had it.
What?
I may have had my wife Susie. Yeah, she's had it on occasion. I probably have had a bite of.
You've never had a full bowl of poutine?
Just a personal preference of not counting my calories, but making my calories count.
I'll have to think about that the next time that we're out for a beer or two.
One beer is two.
Yeah, two is not three. Four. Yes. And on that bombshell, we're going to end for this week. Keep the questions coming. Keep the comments coming. We hope to see you again for another episode very, very soon. So We enjoy it. We enjoy hearing your feedback. Keep it coming, and we'll talk to you next time.